Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Callan, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Okay, well, welcome back to Risk Revolution, our monthly series seeking to advance the maturity of risk management practices across the life science sector. We cover topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech industries and, as always, aim to shake up the paradigm to revolutionize the ways in which we perceive and proactively manage risk. Well, here we are, ladies. Val, Lori and I are going to be all together to talk about the new training materials released last week by ICH around the ICH Q9 or 1. And I guess at first glance, this could sound just like another training release from ICH. But actually, having reviewed them all now, it feels a little bit more important than that. So I guess today we want to ask, is this simply just more supporting material, or is it a clearer signal about what good QRM implementation should look like? Val, over to you. Can you outline what this what was actually released? And didn't we already get a load of training materials in 2023? So what are we really looking at here? An implementation aid, a course, or a quiet reset of the expectations?
That's a good question, Nuala. So my take is this. The earlier materials released soon after the 2023 ICH Q901 update, they were mainly released to explain what had changed. So the focus was naturally on the key additions and clarifications of the R1 update. Better understanding of formality, the role of subjectivity, risk-based decision-making, and that explicit extension of QRM thinking to product availability. In other words, I think those materials were clearly about the new bits. But these new materials are different. Like, my understanding is that the ICH Q9 or 1 training group also recognized that the original Q9 materials, that's going way back to 2005, they did need a kind of a more fundamental rework to reflect how QRM has evolved over the last two decades, I suppose. So this feels less like an update to me and more like a reset, a realignment of the established Q9 expectations, but through a more current lens, if I'm making sense there. So I think that's why the new pack feels important. It's not just a refresh of slides, but a reset, I think, in emphasis. I mean, I feel when people like our good friend, Professor Kevin O'Donnell, and the chair of this training group, Alex Feeman from FDA, when people of that caliber invest time in fully revising the pack, I think we should assume the aim is to improve consistency and understanding in application, really, across the industry. What do you think, Lori? It's a big pack. You broke it down for us.
Yeah, it is a big pack. And I will say that I kind of skimmed over, just taking a step even further back at other ICH guidance documents in terms of their training material. And this one certainly has the most emphasis of most of them. And a lot of them do have nice training material connected with them. This one goes into a lot more detail. So there are 18 sections now. It does open with a nice overview deck. Around just ICH Q9R1, what are those basic quality risk management principles? I think that's a really great overview deck. It does have, here's my beef, always with ICH Q9. It does make nice connections to Q7, Q8, Q10, all of those guidances that link right back into QRM or have principles of QRM in them. I always think a miss, and somehow I think one day we'll make that connection, is ICH E6R3. I know it's good clinical practices. I know that 7, 8, 10 are all about GMP and production, but really Q9's risk management principles are clearly linked back to ICH E6R3 and the clinical risk management principles. They're the same. There's a lot of great linkage there. So I think it's a miss always that those two seem to operate very separately. Maybe someday I'll see those connected together. And then one other thing I'd like to add around the overview deck is that some of my early stage friends that are just, they're phase 1, phase 2, they're trying to get into those risk management principles. I think there's not a lot that speaks to them. I think they would really struggle with a deck like this. They would probably have a hard time sort of understanding how to implement and might abandon ship when really we want those risk management principles to get in there early. It's all about decision making. I don't care what it looks like in terms of formality of tools. We still want to have risk language in those early companies. So I think there's an opportunity there to kind of grow a little bit in that space. But let's talk briefly about the other sections. Big heavy hits on tools, which is great. All around, FMEICA, fault tree analysis, HAZOP, HACCP. I won't go into the details, but it nicely gives a lot of information about all of those tools, fault tree analysis, and has some accompanying examples to go with those. So I think that's really nice. The supporting statistical tools was really nice, a good addition there. It also talks about, it has a section on a combination of tools. How do you link PHA, maybe a preliminary hazard analysis with use of other tools? And then a whole section, a whole grouping of functional areas and how to integrate quality risk management principles into those areas, things like regulatory operations, development, production. So I think that's really nice too, a nice addition. I will say it's a lot of content. It's really deep, a lot of text. So be prepared when you go in there to really take that in. I think it's also a nice foundation to probably build a work instruction or an SOP, depending on how you define that at your company. I think there'll be some good things there. I will say the one module I wanted to go into a little bit of detail about was the basic risk management facilitation methods. I was a little bit disappointed in this one. It was all about tools. It didn't actually even go into how to facilitate, build that risk question, do the pre-work with a team. How do you get the right SMEs in the room? How do you sort of quote herd the cats? We've done some nice sessions, podcast episodes in the past about the challenges with that. So there's good content out there for people, but I think this one really focuses more on flow charts, check sheets, process mapping, great prep tools, but it doesn't really tell you how to use them in a facilitation way. So I struggled a little bit that way. But regardless, I think it's a great combination of content and material. Be ready to be able to be in depth with that and use that material to the best of your, level for your company based on where they're at. I'm going to turn it back to Nuala kind of to go into a little bit more of those tool sections, if you will.
Yeah, thanks, Laurie. I'm a bit like yourself. Look, I'm a bit torn here because, many of the teams that I work with, the first thing that they're asking me for is a request to go through some how-to training on the various tools. And I have to spend some time telling them that and working with them to realize that it's not the tool that's the critical factor in the success of risk management. It's the mindset and approach of the team, like you say, those facilitation techniques that we've talked about many times before, that can have a much bigger impact. But initially, when you're working, particularly with scientific teams and engineering teams, technical people, they really want to understand, oh, what's the difference between this tool and that tool? And they know I don't like FMEA. So they're like, well, if we're not going to use FMEA, what should we be using? And so on that, fact, I'm nevertheless, for my sins, I've been assigned to debrief on the tools. And the good news is that I'm actually delighted to say that the uses and variety of cases and examples of how to apply the tools to the various different scenarios is really rich with information and learnings. Now, it is dense, and I'm not sure a lot of teams would be able to pick this stuff up themselves and really begin to apply it to scenarios. And I would certainly, recommend folks don't just dump all this stuff into SOPs, really get workshops together and start workshopping people through it with these as your backbone. So give them, the blank tools, give them the scenarios, and then work through the different sectors. But before I start on the tools, I'd like to come back to what you were saying about that first pack. You said it's that overview deck, as you say, on the integration of QRM into PQS. I mean, I thought that was a really helpful kind of mind setting in terms of where they want to go. It's great to see the extensive references to the risk knowledge integration cycle, the RKI cycle, from our research colleagues, Marty Lippa and Kevin O'Donnell in there. And, you know, I thought that it was good when, you know, within the first page, they talk about, you know, it's really important that we identify critical areas, we assess potential risks, and number three, we implement controls to ensure product quality and patient safety. And yet so many teams that I work with, they're just focused on the risk assessment. Get the risk assessment. Can we do the risk assessment? What tools for the risk assessment? And again, bringing them around to realizing that the whole risk management program is really around taking those actions, as we, you know, the definition within Q9R1 is the risk controls, which are actions to implement the decisions. And I know, Val, you're going to talk about decisions later. So, you know, I think without, you know, kind of level setting in that first overview deck, it's really important that the teams that are looking to use these recognize that it's about implementing those risk controls, and the assessment is just a mechanism by which we can identify or quantify or score those risk controls in terms of their effectiveness. And I did also like in that overview deck, which is pretty heavy going, I like to see the reference to PICS document on the PQS effectiveness, and I'm sure we're going to be coming back to that PICS document again, the 2021 document, because the EMA have announced that they will be doing a pilot with looking for sites to pilot with them on that implementing PQS effectiveness. So I think that's important. And there was a lovely example also on page 60 of that overview deck that I liked, which was around the contamination control strategy and continuous improvement. So again, I really like that. But let's come back to the decks on the tools. Well, PAC 2 was on FMECA, and they pretty much said, you know, because we always score criticality around that severity, most of what we even call FMEA is actually in effect an FMECA, and the two are synonymous. But I struggled a little bit. They do refer to both on page 12 and 22 about the importance of making sure that we don't just put the detectability in initially, even though when you see it on the template that they offer, you can see detectability going in there. I'm really, really strict about let's score the initial risk first by the severity by probability of occurrence. And don't try and, you know, again, they talk about the fact that we can bring in biases when we stick in that detectability to get us down below the thresholds. It's only after we've calculated the risk that we should then be looking at, and hopefully the preventative controls that we should be looking at, putting in that detectability score, which is an after the outcome. So they do talk about that, but I think it could be lost in the detail. And I think that's one of the key things, certainly when I talk about and train on FMEA or FMECA, is about the importance of moving detectability to the after review section. And on page 26, a really important hierarchy of risk controls. I would urge everybody to go and look at that, because they talk about prevention, they talk about substitution and various other options right down. And the last and least effective of that hierarchy of controls is detectability. So they're quite clear that that's where it sits. But again, I'm just not sure that that nuance would necessarily find its way through, because that deck is very dense. Good examples in Pack 3, which was on risk ranking and filtering. I love risk ranking and filtering because it is so simple, and yet it's not often used. And certainly for things like our site risk register, I mean, that's effectively what we're doing, is a risk ranking and filtering and determining on that. So I thought there was some lovely examples there around how you would set up and determine frequency of site audits for site one versus site two in a network. And they also gave a nice example of how it could be used to determine the impact of CQAs on excipient parameters. So I liked that that deck. Pack 3 was really good. Pack 4, again, comes in on fault tree analysis, really showing it as a root cause analysis.
tool, a useful tool for root cause analysis. And they give another a nice example of an API contamination, an API process with contamination. That PAC5 that you mentioned that they call facilitation tools, which again, it does nothing about facilitation. It just talks about those basic tools of flowchart, process mapping, check sheets, cause and effect, mind maps, and Pareto. Love Pareto. And so I was delighted to see that in there. It's one of my go-to, you know, let's look at the historic data and let's run a Pareto, because that's a great way of weeding out, you know, where we might prioritize to start looking at. So some lovely examples in that little PAC5. And finally, we see HACCP being, you know, coming in from the cold in PAC6. And again, they've emphasized here that it is a really good tool to use for prevention, identifying preventative controls and anything we can do to enhance the way in which we look at prevention. Is great. And they give a lovely 7-step process, which is so easy to use. It's used extensively in the food industry. I mean, you wouldn't walk into any, you know, any commercial kitchen without finding a HACCP application in there. And again, it actually they in PAC 13 under the packaging and labeling lab, they give another great example of how a HACCP can be used to look at incorrect foil and line clearance and reconciliation. So two great examples where HACCP can be used. And I just thought that was great. PAC7, you know, covers preliminary hazard analysis, and we're all fairly familiar with that. So, you know, again, it does say it's good to be used in that, you know, it's a precursor to other studies because it can be used in that early state when we don't have a lot of, you know, a lot of knowledge. So I, you know, there's a huge amount of information and learning in there. You know, I would say, you know, you can't just dump these out on the learning management system and tell people to read and understand them. I would really encourage people to start, you know, over the course of doing some lunch and learns and do some scenario work with this and get teams to work. But finally, I suppose one thing I did want to say is there was tools that I didn't see in there that were omitted. And I was particularly disappointed not to see the bow tie approach, which is, again, a great way of looking at a preventative strategy of identifying what can we do to reduce the likelihood of occurrence, as opposed to what are we doing to for those detectability or mitigating controls, which are all about accepting we've already had the risk event and we're now trying to reduce the impact of the consequences on the business or the patient. So for me, I think that's you know, that's a key thing, and not too much talk about, you know, all the advanced digital tools we should be using now to analyze our historical or surrogate data. I mean, they do talk about statistical tools in one of the decks, but they haven't leaned into the fact that lots of people will be using, you know, AI and other tools now to look at trends and you know, build insights around trends that are looking at risk scenarios. So I suppose coming at it from a person who, you know, is it's anathema for me to spend too much time on the tool and more on the curiosity and the thinking and the mindsets. I'm still really happy to see all of the examples in there, and I hope they see the light of day, because as you've both said earlier, there's some really, really good materials in there, and they've done a fantastic job. What do you think, Val?
Yeah, I agree with nearly everything you've said there, actually, Nuala. I think, you know, many of the tool architectures remain unchanged, of course, because, you know, the tools are the tools, and there's great ISO standards out there that 31100 or something that tells you exactly how all these tools work and can be used, and, you know, the sort of technical architecture of the tools, and of course that's never going to change. I think what was important in these decks is those little insights in how we might be using them or misusing them over the years. And I agree with you, those little insights I think are buried in the density of those slides. And I'm not confident that, regular user Joe would spend the time, or even if they did, could pick out those little nuggets and say, ah, this is maybe where we, need to do a bit more work. And, certainly if they do just get rolled out as a read and understand exercise and people update the procedures and signpost them and do no more, I think there's a lot going to be lost in terms of what they may be subtly laying out in terms of expectations and what might happen, because I think they are trying to imagine those tools in the context of formality and subjectivity. Formality was sharpened under ICHQ9 R1, and I think this, PAC suggests it should influence the way core QRM expectations are applied across all the activities. I mean, I think it's becoming clear formality is not an add-on. It changes how you approach familiar requirements, but I don't think it gave any architecture around navigating your way through toolkits with formality expectations, certainly when they're lower, maybe not higher. Laura, you had some thoughts on that too, did you?
I also struggled with that as well, especially the most part. I work with many clients who are early stage, and I think something like this would be pretty overwhelming to them. I think what would be a nice, I was just thinking of this as you're both talking, what might be a nice addition to, and maybe that's where PICS kind of comes in with this as well, is how do we teach people how to audit a supplier who's maybe doing some of this work for them. So many of my clients may never do a HACCP, for example, but they would audit someone who would do a HACCP for them for cross-contamination or whatever those things are. It might be nice for some of those early stage outsourced kind of business models to have more of a, what do I do at my stage? How am I looking at risk? And how can I apply these principles, but to the vendors that do execute some of this work? So that might be a lighter dose too, because these are so dense, like we talked about. They're more for, I'm going to facilitate this activity, but even then, I better have a strong knowledge of QRM before I start digging into these decks because there is so much information there. So, and likewise, I think some risk ranking and filtering is very commonly used for decision making, for risk logs, for deviation classification, change control classification. But I don't know that people always know that's what they're doing. So I think a lot of work around risk ranking and filtering and how to customize that would be really good for a lot of earlier stage, smaller companies, and even later stage that are making certain decisions or creating risk logs or things like that. I'm glad to hear that those examples are in there. There might be a little bit of more work to do around showing how that can be less formal and more formal, because it's actually quite a tool that can be used in a variety of ways and can be customized in a variety. I think it's probably, when I think about it, one of the more customizable tools in the toolbox that they provided. So I think to your point, Val, drawing it back to where do these things fit in the formality spectrum? Do we have enough at the lower end of simpler tools represented here? I'm not so sure we do, and I don't know that we drew that for the user too.
And I know, because I've heard Kevin O'Donnell say in presentations before that, really any of the tools can be used at either end. They can be
Yes.
applied simply or in a more complex way. So he didn't want to, and I think this may be echoed from the training team, he didn't want to classify tools as simple or
I
highly
see.
formal because they can be used in either context. And I get that, but your example there with risk ranking and filtering is so spot on. And actually, when I was reading that deck, and maybe I'm recalling this in error, but I don't think so, it actually made a point there that risk ranking and filtering was one of the more complicated tools, which made me ask, am I missing something here? Because I wouldn't find it that complicated, So I think there was, even the likes of three of us who were, sort of steeped in this area, there were complicated statements in there, or statements that made me stop in my tracks. So I do worry that people will be able to pull the the nuggets out of it, you know, because likewise, subjectivity, you know, it's not just a new discussion point from 2023. This pack is suggesting it influences how we should approach all our QRM activities. But, you know, and that subjectivity was always present, but we didn't necessarily acknowledge it or manage it properly. But I'm kind of nervous that that didn't get across. How would we do that? Or here are the danger points. There's links at the little bottom in proper writing here and there saying, oh, go look at subjectivity and the subjectivity pack. But, you know, again, I wonder how much more explicit and practical it might have been, you know? And I think the key question that's emerging for me out of this is what does it mean for companies with existing QRM programs? You know, when you look at the 2023 update, you know, did companies facilitate material across all the tools and facilitation methods, or really only circulate the new material? And I've a funny feeling the latter happened in a lot of places, you know. And, you know, then the worry is that our legacy QRM methods and training methods are still going to continue to teach people old habits, and that this new material won't necessarily, you know, be explicit enough for people to change those habits or to change their templates or to change older interpretations. So I think, you know, we really do need to revisit the core ICHQ9 tools and concepts and really look at these with the new lens and, you know, not just the revised sections, you know, or even the revised examples, you know. So I think it may be uncomfortable for some companies. A lot of organizations have technically implemented ICHQ9 for years. It's not been an easy rollout. It's not been easy to get the consistency that was needed across teams, across sites. And companies have had to work so hard at that, you know. And so implementing this in a mature way, I think, is not going to be easy either. You know, it gives people a reason to revisit their long-standing practices and examine the need for an uplift. But, you know, that's not a small body of work either. And I would worry, as you said, Nuala, that people might just look at the pack and download it, not let it challenge their existing systems. Use the pack for awareness rather than a real redesign or an uplift. Maybe don't not even really relate it to the concept of ICU, you know, the important, complex, or uncertain decisions. You know, am I missing links here? I don't know. You know, I mean, Nuala, a lot of this is your wheelhouse, you know, the challenges that it presents to culture, to systems, to implementation approaches. What do you think? I'm worried.
Well, look, the short answer is no, I don't think that this release of this pack is really going to get under the skin of many of those bigger questions around have we got the right culture, you know, are we implementing it in the it w using the right approaches? And I guess it's all part of the maturity that you spoke about earlier. And you know, from my experience working with teams, even the first set of decks that came out in 2023 were not well known to most of the people who are participating, who are risk owners or risk leads or even risk facilitation leads. And you know, I know this may sound disheartening, but the number of people that I will go in and run a workshop with, and they know they're coming to an ICHQ9 workshop, and I'll say, how many of you have read ICHQ9 or one? And a handful of hands in the room will go up that they haven't read the underlying document, and they miss a lot of that. What, you know, a lot of the rationale and the thinking that the regulatory teams put into this, you know, from ICH. And what has happened is maybe Global have implemented that into a global SOP, and then sites have implemented a local SOP, and it loses all of the nuance. And I think the same thing could happen with these decks as well. Now, And as a result of that, you know, risk management on sites is, first of all too often handled as risk assessment, which is, you know, just one tiny little slice of the whole risk management process. And it's still very often, unfortunately, thought of as a compliance requirement. You know, we have to have a risk assessment for this, or we have to have a risk assessment, or we've had a problem and we need to do a risk assessment to demonstrate what we're going to do. And it's not viewed as a business capability, which is certainly how I approach it. You know, if we're making good risk-based decisions, it is good for the business as well as good for the patient, as I always say. And there's still a division between church and state, between the teams undertaking those risk assessments and the management team with responsibility for the oversight of that risk management program and the key decision-making that they're having. And the reporting up, when we talk about risk communications, often I see the reporting goes up into the risk review and risk register and senior management review processes. And the risk communications doesn't go downwards to the frontline teams who are involved, you know, who have the most opportunity to impact on whether a hazard emerges or doesn't emerge, or is detected early or not, or prevented. More importantly, I don't see enough of the frontline teams, whether they're at, you know, from the lab bench or from the shop floor or from the supply chain area or whatever. I don't see enough of them in the room when the risk assessments are happening and the risk control strategy is being determined. And I still find that, you know, this concept of crowdsourcing our risk prevention, we can't crowdsource our risk prevention if we don't go out and get the people who are involved in executing those tasks and get them involved in the risk control strategy design or improvement, continuous improvement. So that's a big problem that I still find out there. You know, we've got certain people who are nominated, whether it's the QRM team or the risk management, the risk leads or product owners, and they're still the people who are in the room. And usually they have a particular bias, and you come back to that subjectivity. You know, they're invested in the system because they've been involved in, you know, designing and developing and implementing it. And therefore, they're less likely to ask questions about, well, why are we doing it this way? Or why, you know, what data do we have to support that? What evidence do we have to confirm that assumption? So, you know, I still, and this, even though I am really glad to see the level of detail that's there, it's going to have to be communicated in a different way other than a 2D deck. You know, we're going to have to see lots and lots of workshop type training around this, you know, whether that's through, you know, the likes of PDA and ISPE, or, you know, that we see a lot of, you know, conference discussions around some of these, or indeed that companies take on the role of running workshops around this, because otherwise those nuances, as you say, the nuggets won't get done. And certainly that approach around culture and around subjectivity and how we implement, it's not covered here. It is very much in the tools. There's hardly, I'm not sure I saw any references to how to reduce. They did talk about bias, but they didn't really talk about how to reduce those subjectivity. Now, there is some good materials in the original 2023 decks. And certainly on the product availability, they have four great case studies in there. I use them routinely when I'm doing work with teams. But God, there's such a canon of knowledge there, which is rich, but it's also impenetrable to people who are busy and just need to get a risk assessment done, because, you know, there's the starting gun has been fired, and they've been given a date to get it closed out by. So yeah, there's a lot there. Laurie, what are your thoughts about how a company might approach a practical rollout of the of all this new knowledge?
Yeah, and I will say too that I think we all agree there's a lot of great content there. It's just, how do I pick and choose what's applicable to my company? And I'll come at this kind of as a from a very pragmatic approach of, I'm a newer, you know, organization into QRM. And I think the first thing, and I know we've all talked about this, and I know, Val, you've had some great articles that you've put out on LinkedIn too. Just talking about risk, just having risk discussions, start there, getting people comfortable with that, testing where is leadership with those discussions, and where is the risk tolerance when you're having those conversations, I think is a great thing to do before you ever start a formalized QRM program if you don't have one in place, because you don't really know where things lie. You're not really sure how to formalize this if you don't really know where the leadership's at and what their tolerance is at, because I think every company is a little bit different. So I would say starting with those conversations, anchoring those conversations around critical decisions that have to be made, and starting to get people to document those conversations. I know that sounds maybe very basic to some of our listeners, but I think some companies are still there. They're still just trying to figure out how to really talk about this because they jumped all the way to we need an FMEA, and they're maybe pumping out formal risk assessments, but are they really even talking about risk and risk decision-making in appropriate forums, right? Really asking those consistent questions of the what might go wrong, how likely is it to go wrong, kind of driving those into normal conversations and meetings gets people kind of used to that. They start to get into the structure without being fed an Excel spreadsheet, right, to get into the structure. So start those conversations and start getting people used to that, and having leadership drive that is before we make a decision. Do we understand the risk around this decision or the options? Do we understand the risks, right? And options that we have. I think that's really good. Then you start getting people to kind of document things in meeting minutes or risk logs. I think that's a good introduction. Again, without a heavy amount of formality, you're got to shift that culture first and give the people the capability before you start throwing them a formal tool. I really think that's all for naught if you don't build that early way of thinking and talking in the meetings and really understanding this is all about decision making. I agree, Nuala. We get hung up on the, do we need a risk assessment for that? And I'm thinking to myself, what kind of decisions are you trying to make? And wouldn't you want to understand the risks around those decisions, right? Like, forget about the formal tool that you think we need. What are we trying to get out of this exercise? Because it should be feeding you something useful for that decision, or why would you do it, right? Again, back to that business alignment. And then during this process, I think you're starting to understand the tolerability. And you're starting to understand how leadership makes decisions and what those expectations are. And that feeds into then you can start to build a global risk management procedure. And okay, global, maybe you have one site in your network. Global may mean you have multiple sites in your network. I think it's very important to have a consistent risk definition around some of those criteria so that everybody's making decisions at the same sort of level, right? And you're consistently applying that. And I think that's one of the most critical things in a formal program that you're going to have. And it's going to take a lot of work to get there if you don't already have that in place. And then defining when you want to have those informal tools in place and informal risk discussions and where the formal stuff comes into play. I think that's very important because I honestly, as a risk practitioner, I'm often telling people, you actually don't need a formal tool for that. Let's look at another way we can do this. I'm usually telling them that and they're trying to throw an FMEA in there. And I'm like, no, we don't need that. Let's make this simpler and more pragmatic. What's the risk question we're trying to solve here? What's the objective of this activity? What decisions are we trying to make? That's going to help me understand the formality and structure. I think the one important thing we need to say too is it's no less powerful to document something with an informal tool than it is with a formal tool. That formality spectrum isn't about how powerful the decision is that you made. It's more about what type of decision are you trying to make. One is no less powerful than the other. It's more, what are you trying to get out of the exercise? What are the questions you're trying to answer? That's what determines the formality you're trying to go into. And then all about when you get more into it, you're going to start clarifying, you know, if you have some formal roles and responsibilities, that's nice. Maybe your company's, you know, an N of one right now for a risk person and that person's trying to manage everything. That's okay too. Maybe you have a QRM department, right? And you're able to have people work in different functional areas and help facilitate. I think that's a next step. Again, you're getting a lot more mature at this point in risk management. And then really starting to get into those tools and training and how to use them and setting up templates and work instructions to help people. I'm trying to walk through this from that less, you know, the early phase all the way into the later phase. And I wanted to do send a little shout out to my outsource companies, as you'll see I do that throughout the podcast. Again, you really, if you're outsourced, you really want to focus on your vendor management. How is your risk decision making around your vendor management oversight? Because that's the power in your company right now. You're not doing a lot of these things internally, so you better understand what's happening externally to some degree and use those risk management approaches to understand that. And then understand the tools from an audit perspective. Are you able to understand how to review some of these more formal tools and risk assessments and the outcomes and decisions and how they're documented? Because you're probably not doing that in-house, but you still need to understand it because they're doing it for you and you're still the sponsor, right? So that's kind of a little step by step of how I would implement that. But Val, I turn to you on really about the maturity and intent of Q9R1, if you want to take that away too.
Yeah, you see that kind of moving from the basics to the advanced practitioners now, the people who've been doing this for a long time, at a global level, if you like. I suppose what does maturity look like now when you add this briefing pack into the equation? You see, I'm kind of beginning to formulate a view that QRM, probably has dual intent, actually, which maybe we don't recognize. I think the first job QRM does for us when we start up is it does identify those risk controls, those proportionate risk controls. Where do we need to focus? What is the, what are the critical things that are happening in our process or our contamination control strategy? And it helps us to identify and apply those controls. And that's one role it plays. And a lot of these tools, they feed that particular implementation of QRM. But the second one, and the one that maybe has evolved since 2005, is that it supports our decision making, as I say, and that we learn to apply it in that context. And so maybe now we have to review, the familiar parts with kind of sharper eyes in that context. Where do these steps, act as living parts to our decision-making processes? Because, risk control on a routine basis requires, decisions when it goes right and decisions when it goes wrong. And if we're not supporting decision-making, if we're simply, one and done, identify the controls, do a risk assessment, file it under a QRM in our share drive, maybe we are just, being a bit performative there, and it is a bit of compliance theatre, as our podcast friend Jeremiah Genest calls it, So, like, just to maybe apply a practical example of that, when I look at the hazard packages, the meaning I'm taking is that hazard identification is no longer just the opening step in the whole process that you have to get through quickly, and used to identify the right alarms to apply and the right controls to apply. I would see now it's asking us to go a step beyond. What critical decisions will we be making if that alarm on the fridge goes off? How would you know that it's responded to correctly? How would you know that the right signals are read? What do you do when the whole a dashboard of alarms lights up? Because the reality is that the risk isn't always appreciated at that moment, and that the decisions made, even in response to something very simple, a simple alarm on a fridge, they can be poor decisions. So the controls are in place, but the decision control isn't perhaps there. And again, there's formality spectrums one could apply there. I mean, if the decision, the reaction to an alarm is going to be pretty routine, then we can formalize it as a rule. We can set into our procedures a rule that says this is how we react. These are the things you check. It's not everything's a deviation. This is where you log it. This is where you document it. And these are the circumstances when you escalate it. So I think in the workplace we need to move even our hazard analysis and layer on everything that's going on in the space, how the hazard is really emerging in a complicated, busy workspace, so that we can ensure that everything is recognized, understood, acted upon, and managed appropriately. We're not just scoring things, we're looking at how they actually happen. And likewise, you could take risk evaluation. I mean, it's not a number in a risk assessment that crosses a threshold. It is about the judgment and context and proportionality you apply when you're evaluating that risk in the real moment. The OOS on your cleaning. What do you do? The low yield, the environmental monitoring action limit that's just been exceeded, the unexpected intervention in an aseptic fill. What makes these situations acceptable and not acceptable? And I think that's where the maturity comes in. We're not replacing the old structure. I think the new expectation is, and the new ask is, how intelligently we use it, Yes, it's bringing more attention to our formalities, so to our subjectivity, to the quality of our reasoning. And whether that is actually, I think that's what you were talking about, Nuala, whether that reasoning is actually useful then for the decision-making moment. And, so in that sense, I think the familiar steps are still there, but maybe we've been asked to read them with a greater depth, a greater discipline, maybe a greater honesty, and a greater sense of reality, maybe. So I think the bar is being raised for how thoughtfully, how proportionately, and how honestly we apply this maturity. It's not a new map. I think it's the same map, but it's kind of got an illuminating light now coming with it. Yeah.
Thank
So
you.
look, I don't know. What do you think?
So just on that, there's a couple of things that you've triggered for me, and it's one of the things that I tend to do now since the distinction in 2023 R1 came out around hazard identification. I routinely recommend teams to break these things up into different activities on different days, separate them in time. So I like to have the hazard ID workshop. Like you say, don't present them with a spreadsheet. I like it to be a brainstorming, maybe you're using a process map. And this is covered in the combo tools pack 14, where they talk about you can use a combination of tools. And I do tend to recommend that we use a combination of tools. And not only that, but we recommend, that I recommend that we use a combination of a kind of thinking when we're at that hazard identification stage. Just like you say, Val, that it's important that we're thinking about what can go wrong, as well as, at the point in time that it might go wrong, and when might we, what the scenario might be. And I want that to be kind of blue sky brainstorming, risk ranking, and filtering type activities where people are up on their feet and they're thinking about it. Could be, overall using a Nishikawa or something for hazard identification, having different teams looking at, at methods and manpower and the way around, and then walking the walls to change the teams around to add post-its and things like that. So I like that to be a very kind of blue sky thinking of what could go wrong and when those scenarios might occur, and have we had experience of them before, and what did we do in terms of how did we get ourselves out of those scenarios previously. And then for the facilitator to actually pull all that down and put that into whatever tool is going to be used for the risk evaluation tool, and separate that in time, because it's a different type of thinking than when we get into that risk evaluation where we're looking at either qualitative criteria or quantitative criteria and making sure that that criteria is has been customized for the risk question or the process in train. And now you can get people into thinking specifically, come with your data, come with your knowledge, come with your tacit and explicit knowledge. And let's pool that around evaluating, how are we going to come up with a probability? Are we going to use some of our statistical tools? Have we got, whatever it might be, Power BI or something that we're going to use to look at our trends and various things? And that might help us then get to the reasoning around, you know, are our current controls, or are the controls that we're planning to put in effective? Are they likely to be effective? What are our assumptions? And therefore, what kind of oversight monitoring do we need to do, an evaluation of that on a frequency through our CPV programs or other programs? And I did see a reference in there around the fact that, you know, they do recommend that that ongoing monitoring that we're certainly, they talk about, it's not just the annual product review or the PQRs. You want to be leveraging other ongoing monitoring programs routinely. And I think that that's a really important, again, that little nuance might mean nothing to those of us, you know, who aren't familiar, as you say, steeped in this. So it is about getting to that reasoning. Now, I do have to say, again, I like some of the examples that they're giving in those case study packs at the end. They've got one on QRM in production, one in supply chain, one in lab controls, you know, and there is some really good examples in there about how, like you mentioned the OOS, there's a very good example in there on OOS investigations on a stability sample. And they, in the, you know, it's quite well fleshed out, and it's a nice scenario that they've used. So there's opportunities to find cases that would be reflective of where those, hopefully those frontline people, as well as some of the SMEs that were getting involved in our risk management activities, where they're coming from, where they will, you know, be familiar with cases of their own that can resonate for them. So I do, again, that back end of this very extensive set of decks, there are, again, really, really useful things in, you know, in those decks, really rich learnings. But again, I just fear that it won't be picked up, and it won't be applied in the way that we, you know, that we would like to see it, you know. Lori, what about yourself?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a few final thoughts. I think because of that text-rich material, I'm a person who is very visual in terms of when I'm trying to execute or learn how to do something. I think video tutorials would be really useful in the future. I know that's a next level maybe for what ICH wants to do, but I think for when you're talking about some of these complex tools, it took me a long time to learn fault tree analysis and apply it. And I had a coach kind of working with me to give me feedback. I think some of those kind of tools, HACCP especially, I mean, my goodness, I think I took a week long course in a classroom with a trainer to learn something like that. Again, I think these training materials are intended to give us a start, right? They're intended to give us something to work with. But I think things like that would be really helpful, I think, to the community. We're a lot of years out now. What are we at now? 2005, right, was when the original ICHQ9 came out. And we're still struggling quite a bit. So I don't know if throwing the same types of things with more words in it is going to help. Maybe we need to change up our tactics a little bit and think about how there are lots of ways to learn, and not everybody's into reading text-rich stuff, you know, for tool execution. That may need to require some other kind of creative thinking about that. So that's an option. I also want to say that I do think these decks are great. And for someone at our level of expertise, and we've been doing this for years, there's excellent information in here. I'm more worried about those folks that are trying to learn this, get into it, maybe even get a little deeper knowledge. There might be a little bit of a challenge there in terms of maturity of the company and maybe where the QRM practitioner is at too. I'm going to go back to it, and I'm not going to let it drop, because someday I think it's going to change. ICHQ 6R3 and our good clinical practices friends, they're doing the same thing, and they're struggling because they're a little bit behind, right? Where the GMP, you know, quality oversight of GCP is kind of a new piece. The quality groups are getting more into the clinical practices. There are CQA practitioners out there that don't really understand this stuff. And I think if we could help bridge those two worlds, I think that would be amazing, because we've built a certain maturity over here on the GMP side, and we're getting a little bit better. Maybe we could bridge those worlds and help out that side of the product life cycle too, right? And I think I think in terms of that, I've probably said my piece about early stage companies and helping some of those companies come along into this world. I think I've talked about that enough. So I'm going to turn it over to Val to close this out.
Yeah, but you're right to call it out because it's a critical part of the product life cycle. And we're supposed to be taking this overview approach, but in some ways we're siloing, well, the process is siloing and chunking it out, the same as the companies are siloing and chunking it out. And it's not giving us that life cycle overview, so that is a problem. And just on your visuals. I mean, there's probably people now doing QRM that weren't even born in 2005 when it came out
Yes,
first. I hate to
great point.
reflect on that, but that's probably true. And so many of the younger folks, are visual learners. They look up, YouTube videos and Instagram and TikTok to know how to do anything. So, I do fear that the density of this material is going to be so off-putting here, But anyway, I'll bang my final drum as well and bring it back to, there was one final, there was the final deck, I think 19 in there, which is QRM as part of regulatory inspection and operations. And I think that deck does help position QRM as a decision support discipline, not simply as a risk assessment tool. Now, maybe I was reading it with a whole dollop of confirmation bias, but
Yeah, I like that.
I did sneak it out there and think, I think it is mentioned, So I think the big call out is, look, I think the deck helps us read the existing philosophies and our existing applications a little bit more coherently, and maybe to apply it all a little bit more intelligently, because the output of QRM is not a form. It is better judgment. And I think that is the most important signal in this revised pack. And I think we need to start asking ourselves, or stop asking ourselves, have we done a risk assessment, and start asking ourselves, did this QRM activity actually help us make better, more defensible decisions? Which decisions is it helping? Where? And do we need to take further action? Linking it again to that KM strategy, which is getting a whole lost in our conversation here because there's so much to talk about. But do we need to collect more knowledge to improve our decisions? Or do we need to link knowledge to the decision maker and where they're standing in the operation? So, I think if the industry takes this and gives it a more mature read and links it to what we've known and all the discussions we've had about QRM maturity, then this package could really kind of rock and roll. But did it need to be more explicit in making that connection? That's my parting concern there.
Okay, well, listen, I guess that's a wrap, ladies. That took us a long time because there's so much in it.
A lot.
Yeah, indeed. So as usual, we'll be back each month with a range of topics and a mix of guest interviews. So please do subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, so new episodes will miraculously make their way into your feed. Again, don't forget to join us on the LinkedIn Risk Revolution podcast page. Please do join us there. Feel free to message us there for any of with any of your thoughts or ideas. And Val, apart from signposting the materials, is there anything else that we have for the show notes this month?
I think that's all we're going to put in the show notes is the link to the briefing pack. And there you
Probably the most show notes we'll ever have.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. So look, it's a goodbye from Nuala.
Goodbye from Lori.
And goodbye from Val.